It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democratic candidate for governor Mary Burke released her jobs plan this morning. We'll talk to two reporters and a political scientist about the specifics of the plan and how it might play out in the election this fall.
It's hard to distill 3,000 years of history into a single story, but that's what our guest now has done, taking a look at the cultural and historical pieces, big and small, that together describe a part of the Jewish experience.
The history of the Jewish people spans over three millennia. It includes slavery, genocide, mass migrations, and exiles. Throughout these various forms of persecution, the Jewish religion still survives and the people still thrive across different distant parts of the globe.
In his new book and documentary series, Simon Shama says that endurance may actually be what it means to be a Jew, an ability to overcome and to thrive.
The documentary is called The Story of the Jews. It premieres tonight at 7 on your local PBS station. Simon Shama, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's fine being here.
You begin your series by asking what a Jew is, and there isn't an obvious answer. How do you tackle that question?
No, it isn't an obvious answer, really, because actually, you know, as I say, Jews look quite differently, every color of skin, every imaginable accent. But what I say binds Jews together is their sense of belonging to the same story, and also an extremely strong sense that through words, through the story, survival has actually happened. The Jewish experience is not, I think, unique in terms of what a persecuted people has to go through, but it is rather special in terms of being able to survive when the usual things that help you endure, an army, political institution, territory, is taken away from you, and you simply use portable writing. That's what happened with the Jews in several centuries, even before the Bible was finished, and you know, it's how we've managed to cohere over the centuries.
Writing this history is a project that you basically put off for decades. What made you embrace it now?
Precisely the introduction. It is completely impossible to actually do a television series in 5 hours about the entirety of Jewish history. But I don't know. I just thought the time now, there is so much misunderstanding. Anti-Semitism is on the rise. It turns out that other than the destruction of the planet, the single most intractable problem we have in the world right now is how do peoples of different beliefs share the same living space without the obligation to oppress or even kill each other? And the Jews have a very particular story to tell to non-Jews as well, I think. It's an outward story very often. That's to say, Jewish history has never really been separate from non-Jewish history. Jews have never even lived separately unless they've been forced to live separately. And there are all kinds of resonances, I think, for our perplexities and dilemmas in the modern world that I wanted to try and explain and tell that particular story.
And you don't just tell the story of persecution and exile. You also try to just tell the stories of some of the people as far back as you can go, given the historical record, given the stories of the stories that have been passed down. Who are some of the first people we meet in the earliest recorded history?
Well, that's a tricky thing, because actually the meeting point of the Bible is not reliable history. The Bible is, you know, certainly the story of the Exodus. There's no archaeological evidence for it. Excitingly, as we explore in the first program, recent excavation seems to have shown that there was a kind of mini Judean state based on Jerusalem, presumably ruled over by King David. We know King David did actually exist from a stone inscription from the 9th century BC found in the northern Israeli town of Dan. So, you know, David is a kind of ghostly presence in some way, but there he is in this imposing citadel fortress on the boundary of where Judeans and Philistines are supposed to have fought a battle. But, you know, the great figure in the Jewish Bible is invisible, faceless, formless, the personality of the unpredictable and always difficult Jewish God. And he's actually there through emptiness. There is extraordinary stone, tiny little model shrines that were also found on the same site, a place called Kibbet Kiafa. And they're very beautifully fashioned on the outside. But inside, instead of having animal gods or the images of pagan deities, there is simply dark, echoing emptiness. And it's from that emptiness that the beautiful words of the biblical faith were fashioned.
One of the things that excited you about taking on this project, I gather, was new historical artifacts, new sources that had come to light or maybe were newly understood. Yeah. Could you tell us about some of those?
Well, there is one thing that, you know, about the Jewish obsession with words is that it sounds as though it's meant for your program and would be great radio. But actually what's been uncovered increasingly over the last few decades are the place of images, of mosaic images particularly, in the history of the early synagogues. And this always comes as a shock to Jews and non-Jews who think that the second commandment, thou shalt not have graven images, meant to kind of ban on all images, particularly in synagogues themselves. But we know now from archaeological evidence this was not so. For the first 500 years, synagogue after synagogue, some have even been discovered with vibrant wall paintings, and not just of abstract patterns and animals and beasts, but actually pictures of people. In the case of one extraordinary Syrian synagogue, which I deal with in a book, we alas couldn't film because of the Syrian civil war, there are portraits of biblical figures of Moses and David and Solomon and Samuel. And this is a really drastic revision, one of the many drastic revisions to the way we think about the first synagogues after the destruction of the temple. For all you women out there, there is absolutely no evidence of any kind of separation of the sexes in the first half millennium of synagogue life.
That's something that's going to be controversial to some people, as are, I'm sure, other elements
already,
of telling
really
the story.
I've under the excommunication, I think, actually. And no, I've been, you know, struck off the gefilte fish list, I think, actually. So it's just too bad.
Well, is this a hard story to tell? Because within the Jewish community, I'm sure there's a lot of disagreement over basic questions of history and identity, and among Jews and non-Jews.
Surely you chaff.
I think I understate.
No, I describe very often communication among Jews as agreed mutual interruptions. And we thrive, really, by endless arguments and a lot of kind of mutual shouting. Even in we're about to have Passover, and all my Jewish friends out there will be going to Seder services, and we read from the storybook of the Passover, the Haggadah, and there are rabbis arguing furiously with each other over practically everything long into the night. So Judaism is a kind of, it's a religion, it's not a religion bound by obedience and authority, except to some of the core laws of the Torah, of the Bible. It's a religion which entertains and welcomes contradictions. The Talmud, which we show through, I think, extremely beautiful graphic, actually done by a Torah scribe and an animator, the Talmud has on any single page five different versions interpreting the same text. So, you know, we were kind of postmodern quarrelers before postmodernism was invented.
Simon, you write that the story of the Jews is really a story that you can't really pull out from the fabric of history as a whole. It's part of that whole.
Yeah.
How can we begin to think about it like that?
Well, I think actually Judaism doesn't really have a theology in the sense in which Christianity does, or possibly even Islam does. It does have a set of rules for living, and it has stories around how those rules were received and transmitted. But one thing it has, which was extraordinary and appears in the Bible early on, is the commandment to remember. And what you're remembering, really, is not just a set of the kind of moral precepts embodied in the Ten Commandments, but this extraordinary story of backsliding and impurity and disobedience and resistance, which is really all part of the human condition. So the Jewish God is a God who, at times, really walks among the mayhem that men create, and then he goes off in a huff and disappears only to return with dire punishments, or just turn his back, really, on his disobedient people. So it is, as you say, an extremely kind of fleshed out kind of religion. A lot of the gigantic coral reef of commentary, which is the Talmud, is wonderful to me because it's based on daily minutiae. I mean, one point in the Talmud, I couldn't quite believe what I was reading. Again, it's a Passover story. Two rabbis have discovered that one of the materials which is used to basically for waxing, I have to say, as a depilatory, to remove hair from the skin of gorgeous young Jewish princesses, was made partly of flour paste. This meant that it wasn't proper to use it during Passover, when we're not supposed to eat flour. Then these rabbis embark on this extraordinary sort of discussion of, well, you know, which is the best depilatory? How do they know? You know, really? Nevertheless, they can't stop talking about it. This is the Talmud.
Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with historian Simon Shama. His documentary, The Story of the Jews, airs tonight at 7 on your local PBS station.